It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. He's the second longest serving mayor in the history of Pittsburgh, and since 2006 has been a senior resident fellow and chair for urban development at the Urban Land Institute in Washington, D.C. But Tom Murphy still gets home every weekend. Tom Murphy, welcome to the confluence.
Kevin, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you. Next month will mark 25 years since your first election as mayor. So I want to start with, how did you view the city then, its potential, its challenges, and how do you see it now?
Well, I always saw a huge potential in Pittsburgh, but 25 years ago, Pittsburgh was in the midst of a serious decline. Between 70 and 90, we had lost almost 400,000 people from the region, and they weren't they were largely our kids that were leaving, young people, and so the steel industry had largely left, and so we were facing a really uncertain future about what we were going to become. And funny, Bill Peduto and I were on a panel earlier this week, and he said, you know, we're mayors of the same city, but we were mayors of very different cities. Because I was trying to figure out how to manage, we were managing decline and trying to figure out how to grow Pittsburgh, and Bill is trying to manage the problems of growth, of affordable housing and lots of other things. And, you know, we were giving away houses back in 1994. Pittsburgh had lost half of its population. And it wasn't, you know, we had thousands of acres of old industrial property like Southside Works, Somerset at Frick Park, now the slag dump. And, you know, and it's changed. I was leading a tour a couple of weeks ago of some visitors that came to Pittsburgh and got lost in East Liberty.
Got lost.
The roads got changed and the buildings looked so different. I didn't recognize where I was. It was a very, very telling moment.
So how did your working with reusing, repurposing land in the city of Pittsburgh, how did it help you in sort of your current position with Urban Land Institute?
Well, what I've come to realize, and I've been to 70 cities in the last year, to give you a sense of everywhere from Germany to Hong Kong to Lafayette, Louisiana, and Loveland, Colorado, what everybody's looking for their place in the world, because the rules have fundamentally changed with globalization and technology, and so they look to Pittsburgh and said, how did you go from this failing industrial city with having one of the highest unemployment rates to the city we have now that's recognized by The Economist and others as the most livable city, one of the most livable cities in America. Right. How does that happen? And that story of how it happens in the partnerships that we had, you know, with the people willing to invest in a new Pittsburgh, the foundation community, the corporate community of Pittsburgh, and most importantly, the universities. Right. I mean, the first person I ever heard talk about the universities as the economic engine was Dr. Syrett, who was president of Carnegie Mellon University in the early 80s. And as the steel industry was collapsing, and we were having meetings to say, where are people going to work in Pittsburgh? He said the universities can be the economic drivers, and none of us understood what that meant. Did that mean you're just going to make the universities bigger? And he said, no, we can create the new industries, and look what's happened.
Well, there's a reason why they always call it eds and meds, isn't there?
Yeah. So
I'd like you to take a listen to something right now. It's from December 2005. We're actually talking in your office as you're wrapping up 12 years as mayor of Pittsburgh. And I ask you about your achievements and in which you take pride.
Right.
And you mention the riverfronts.
There are hundreds of residences on the riverfronts. There's pretty much a continuous park along the city's riverfronts now, almost 25 miles of public space on the rivers, lots of office buildings. And all that happened because we got people to wanting to invest in Pittsburgh again.
All right. You never missed an opportunity to talk about the riverfronts when I was covering you as mayor. But you always talked about public access to rivers. So what I'd like to know is, what do you think what's happened along the rivers since you left office?
It's wonderful. I mean, it was my dream that it would happen. Part of it was pure selfishness, Kevin, as I love to run and ride bikes. And so I had, you know, long before I was mayor, I was running through old steel mill sites on the South Side and never thought I'd ever be mayor of Pittsburgh. And so when I became mayor, I wanted to capture that opportunity. And, you know, one of the really highlights of when I was mayor, I was standing over by the water steps on the north side,
right.
and this couple comes riding down on bikes, and they came over and said, "We love these trails, thank you." And they're 86 and 84 years old, and they hadn't been on bikes in 60 years, but they felt comfortable getting on a bike on that trail. It's off the roads. They don't have to worry about traffic. It's flat. They loved it. And I thought to myself, how we've changed people's lives by building that trail, giving them a real high quality of life, an opportunity to have recreation or walk or ride bikes or run. And it's just, and it's created huge economic value if you look at what's happened all along the waterfronts now. And the challenge is to finish the missing pieces for Pittsburgh and to continue to expand up the Allegheny River and through the Strip District so that there would be a continuous connection. But it creates, I think, the great value for the Pittsburgh.
Yeah. And a quick follow-up to that is this could easily be developed industrial or, you know, big-time corporations,
right.
but you always want to focus on public being able to
I mean, from my point of view, that was one of our values, principles that we needed to stick to. So when Alcoa wanted to build their building, or PNC Bank built their headquarters on Grand Street there, or the Steelers and UPMC built their sports medicine facility and the headquarters and practice field of the Steelers, all of those companies initially did not want the trail. They were worried about security, and they wanted the riverfront. We said basically is that, you know, we really want you to be there, but you got to give that 50 or 100 feet for a public access, and you can see what's happened.
I want to ask you about police community relations. It doesn't seem like it really changes much. So near the end of your first term in office, black residents made a series of civil rights complaints against police. It led to the consent decree.
Right.
To help avoid litigation.
Right.
So two decades later, do you see any real improvement of police relations with the community?
I think the police are trying, but I don't. I think it's a very challenging issue. On one hand, you have crime in communities, and police need to be there to deal with that crime. And sometimes that's not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the same time, you have community leaders and others who, you know, are concerned about the police and the impact on particularly young African-Americans in those neighborhoods. So I think it has to be a continuing conversation that goes on. We tried very hard over the 12 years I was mayor. I think Bill Peduto is trying very hard to continue to build that relationship with. It's really 200 years of mistrust is what we're talking about you're trying to overcome. I think it has to continue to work. You need to work towards that trust, but it's a very challenging issue.
And we have just a few minutes left. I want to ask you, you took some heat for how you funded development or how you proposed,
right,
and
right.
whether it was the marketplace at
right.
Fifth and Forbes, which didn't come to fruition
right.
per se, but also the building of PNC Park in Heinz Field. So whether it's tax incentives or using sales taxes or whatever the Peduto administration is offering to Amazon, how much of a risk is that in using public dollars to fund major projects?
What we always tried to do is we tried to look at the market and basically say, where do we need to be competitive? Let me give you an example. If a developer has a choice to develop over in the old steel mill in Southside or to develop out in Hampton Township on a green field, how do I make that old steel mill site competitive that
right.
they want to
right.
locate there, particularly when there's nobody's sure what the market's going to be? It's the same with ballparks or anything else or Amazon, is that, you know, I would say I don't like to give public subsidies, but the reality is that's the marketplace. You can stand on your principle and say, we don't want to give you any subsidies, Amazon. We don't want to give you money, Pittsburgh Pirates. Well, we would not have a baseball team. And we wouldn't have a hockey team. You know, Kansas City had just built a brand new arena, and they were trying to entice the Penguins to move to Kansas City. So you're competing in a market, and that's the challenge. How do you compete in a way that creates value for your city and at the same time attracts the business that you want to come here?
Right. Very briefly, in recent years, Pittsburgh's gotten increased national attention, right, both through circumstance, perhaps some posturing. Would you, as mayor, wanted that spotlight? Do you think it helps the city long term?
I think it helps the city. I hear about it in all my travels that Pittsburgh has. And once, in many ways, I get invited to go to all these places because of Pittsburgh's positive reputation now of going from this economically depressed area to this booming area. So I think that is good. And what the most important piece of it is, it's attracting young people back to Pittsburgh. We are seeing a lot of young people changing the face of Pittsburgh, which is really good for us and for the future.
All right. About 30 seconds left. It's January 1994. Inauguration Day. In your speech, you quote Robert Frost, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. So in these last 30 seconds, would you change the road that you took?
No, what we did was we moved from managing decline to reimagining Pittsburgh. So look, we made very controversial decisions. We bought thousands of acres of old industrial property, which are now Somerset of Frick Park. We did the Sears building with a Home Depot that created the development. So we took big risk. Some of them worked, some of them didn't, but we were probably batting 80%. That's not bad. Thank you, Kevin.
Tom Murphy was mayor of Pittsburgh for 12 years. He's currently a senior resident fellow at the Urban Land Institute. Tom, thanks so much
thanks
for coming
lot,
out.
Kevin.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Zombie fans can now drink like the living dead. A new pop-up bar in Market Square called The Zombie Den, Bar of the Living Dead, inspired by George Romero's classic film, will feature cocktails with names like Apocalypse Punch and Penicillin. It's open through early next month. And powerful storms brought tornadoes through Pennsylvania this week. One touched down near Erie, hitting a nursing home and prompting evacuations, but no one was injured. And two others were reported in Greene and Lycoming counties. Get more top news by signing up for our newsletter at wesa.fm/inbox edition.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Getting into legal trouble is overwhelming, especially if you lack resources and an understanding of your circumstances. Keystone Crossroads' Annette John Hall tells us about a community-based public defenders program in Philadelphia that helps poor defendants navigate the criminal justice system.
Steve Austin wishes he could take back that afternoon in 1975.
I killed a person. I took a person's life. And it's hard for me to talk about it.
He was 16 years old, sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
I have a greater understanding of what has happened. As a child, you might not fully understand the things that you've done.
Austin didn't know much about how the legal system worked when he was charged and sentenced, and more knowledge probably would not have changed his outcome. But with it, he says he could have presented himself as somebody worthy of redemption.
Oftentimes, when you're in a courtroom, what happens is the judge doesn't know you. You know, the attorney really doesn't know you. It's the community of people that you live in. They know you.
Austin was released from prison last year after 42 years when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that juvenile lifer sentences be reevaluated.
Well, okay then, we might as well get started.
Now, he's facilitating a program run by the Philadelphia Public Defender's Office.
So we try to find out what individual has the earliest court date.
It's called participatory defense, and it helps people charged with crimes be better advocates for themselves.
We encourage people to make sure that they have put together a package that allows them to present themselves as a whole person.
The package includes training defendants about the facts of their case, teaching them how to write a biography, obtaining letters of support, and identifying friends and loved ones who can come to court to vouch for them. Chief Defender Keir Bradford Gray says the Philly Defender's Office had to get creative to do battle with the better resourced District Attorney's Office. So, when she saw a model of the Participatory Defense Program in California, she said,
"That's it. Public defenders need that type of collaboration, that untapped resource of the community to help us understand what's going on."
Veronica Rex is an example of a participatory defense success story. She found the program by accident when she showed up for grief counseling in the same building.
My son, 26 years old, was murdered on February the 11th, 2018. Shot in the back of the head and several times, and the case is still open. They haven't found anyone at this point.
Her son's murder came 9 years after her 22-year-old daughter was killed.
It took a lot out of me. It appeared like my whole world had just crashed in.
During this time, Rex was also worried about her own court case. She had just been incarcerated for 3 months on gun charges based on handling a customer's weapon at a bar where she worked.
Because I stepped outside to give the gun back to the person, I then was charged with having a gun on the streets of Philadelphia.
She also had a felony conviction from 30 years ago hanging over her head. And as she awaited sentencing, she feared it would hurt her cause. Her lawyer wanted her to take a deal, but she would still face jail time. Participatory defense helped Rex draft a letter to the court explaining her perspective. And with that, things began to swing in her favor.
I was able to get my court date changed to give me more time to prepare and get together my bio, because I'm more than just what they see there on paper.
The judge dropped her felonies to misdemeanors, and instead of jail time or house arrest, she got 3.5 years probation.
Without their support, possibly sitting in behind bars again, or possibly sitting looking out my window trying to get okay to go to the swimming pool with the grandchildren.
Rex now volunteers for the program to help others, just like the program helped her.
Okay. All right, so we're looking at the 21st as the earliest date.
Steve Austin says Rex is not alone. He's seen firsthand how the program can change the course of people's lives.
This participatory defense, you know, is revolutionary. And I don't use that word lightly.
Annette John Hall, Keystone Crossroads.
This story is part of the Keystone Crossroads series, No Justice for All. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. A longtime Pittsburgh arts group has suspended operations. The shutdown of the Silkscreen Asian American Film Festival comes as allegations of sexual harassment against the group's executive director are surfacing. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports.
This week, 2 days after wrapping its 13th annual festival, Silkscreen shut down, citing financial challenges. The announcement came just a day after one of its 3 salaried employees, who had just been laid off that morning, went on Facebook Live to condemn the group.
This is the time, this is the climate right now to bring this stuff to light. And I really need your help so that this man can never go and do this to another woman again.
Serenie Welsby says Silkscreen's board of directors was covering up long simmering allegations of sexual harassment by the group's founder and director, Harish Saluja. Silkscreen's mission is to celebrate Asian and Asian American culture through film, dance, and music. Welsby says the board asked her to sign a release that offered her $1,000 but prohibited her from discussing her experiences there. WESA has spoken with 8 Silkscreen staffers or interns dating back to 2014. All say they experienced or witnessed conduct by Saluja ranging from verbal abuse to sexual harassment. Welsby was the group's operations and programming assistant. She says Saluja often told her and other female employees how to dress.
He said, "I've seen your Facebook photos, and I know that you can look sexy, and I need you to look sexy when you're with me, because you represent me, and I need to look good." Basically, like, I felt like a arm candy.
Sarah Miller worked at Silkscreen in 2015 and 2016. She recalls a discussion with Saluja after a board meeting.
He said, "You have a sexy voice, so you should speak up so they can hear you louder." I think I just sat there shocked that that's something that he actually said to me.
A former Silkscreen intern said Saluja often made inappropriate comments around staffers.
I remember one of our first conversations we ever had was like at a coffee shop, and he said something about a b-.
This former intern, who asked that her name not be used, recalled another incident.
I would be doing my computer work, and he would be sitting right behind me and supposedly looking at the computer screen while looking down my shirt because I caught him one time, and then he goes, "I'm sorry for staring at your."
In August, Welsby voiced her concerns to the board. Then she learned that Miller, her predecessor, had reported Saluja's alleged harassment and verbal abuse to the board in 2016, but that the only result was an emailed apology from him to the interns. Welsby collected stories from several former workers and submitted them to the board. Immediately after, she says, board members began appearing in the office whenever Saluja was there as sort of chaperones, but Saluja was not fired.
We talked to the board, we tried to work with them, and they just refused to cut out the cancer that was Harish.
A spokesperson for Silkscreen said Wednesday that the group is aware of the allegations and, quote, actively addressing them at this time. She said the document Welsby was asked to sign was a standard release unrelated to the allegations against Saluja. An attorney for Saluja said Mr. Saluja denies ever sexually harassing any woman at work or otherwise. Saluja is also a volunteer host of Music from India, a long-running program on WESA. In a statement, a WESA spokesperson said the station had suspended its relationship with Saluja and the program and was conducting a confidential inquiry into the allegations. Silkscreen is not a large group. A 2016 federal tax filing, the most recent available, shows its revenue declining by half from just 4 years earlier to $139,000. But the group's honorary advisory board includes Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto. In September, Miller, the former Silkscreen staffer, alerted Peduto's office to the allegations. A mayoral spokesperson says Peduto then canceled plans to attend the September 21st gala that kicked off this year's Silkscreen Film Festival. The University of Pittsburgh's Film Studies program, which once sent interns to Silkscreen, has also cut ties with the group. A recent email purportedly from a Pitt professor to Silkscreen indicated that interns had complained of sexually discriminatory behavior. But Film Studies Director Randall Holly said the school stopped sending interns there a year ago for reasons unrelated to alleged sexual misconduct. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
Republicans say an FBI report has found no evidence for sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Attorney Michael Avenatti isn't surprised. Avenatti represents Julie Swetnick, the third woman to accuse Kavanaugh of misconduct. He was in Pittsburgh Thursday on his way to talk to Youngstown Democrats, and he told 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter the FBI did not speak with his client or with witnesses who could back up her story.
The FBI investigation, I think, is an absolute joke, not because of the work done by the FBI, but rather as a result of the scope of the investigation being controlled by the White House and the Senate Republican leadership, because Donald Trump nor the Senate Republicans are actually interested in the truth. They're only interested in ramming this nomination through as quickly as possible in the interest of politics.
At this point, would you expect his confirmation to go through based on how it's shaping up here?
I don't know what's going to happen. I think the Republican leadership and Trump have basically set up a situation where they have now impugned the integrity and the reputation of the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Supreme Court of the United States, likely for an entire generation. You know, the tone is set at the top. Never in my lifetime did I think that I would watch the President of the United States stand at a lectern publicly in front of thousands of people and mock a woman that claimed that she was a victim of sexual assault. I thought it was an absolute new low in a series of new lows for Donald Trump, and that's saying something.
Obviously, you are publicly pondering a run for president here. Youngstown, Ohio is the kind of place that Donald Trump was able to win over and probably drove him to his election here. What do you think people in a place like Youngstown need to hear from Democrats that they haven't been hearing in recent cycles?
Above all else, I think I can beat Donald Trump. And if you can't beat Donald Trump, you don't have any business running for the Democratic nomination. Democrats better nominate somebody that can take the fight to this guy and engage in a brutal campaign for this nation and the values and the principles upon which it was founded. This nation cannot afford our gentleness. My approach is you have to fight fire with fire And if they hit you, you've got to hit back twice as hard.
That was Michael Avenatti, an attorney and potential 2020 presidential contender, speaking with 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Westmoreland Symphony Orchestra has been a cultural mainstay for Greensburg and the surrounding communities since it was founded in 1969. The symphony's 50th anniversary season kicks off next week. And joining me now in studio to talk about it, Executive Director Endicott Reindl. Endy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Artistic Director Daniel Meyer. Daniel, welcome.
Good morning, Kevin.
All right. So the orchestra is a half century old. So what need was there for a symphony in this community when it started? I know you haven't been around that long.
No, it's interesting because a lot of these orchestras started off as, to some degree, a community orchestra, an orchestra of people that loved to play music, maybe had some, well, definitely had some formal music training, and may have even had an undergraduate or graduate degree in music, but pursued other careers or had other lives and wanted to get together and perform symphonic music.
Exactly.
And Westmoreland Symphony is one of those.
Yeah. And it formed very earnestly because a lot of folks in the community felt that there was such a void because at the time, Pittsburgh Symphony was doing regional concerts all around the area. And, you know, but they would come, you know, say in January and they come back in December, whatever have you. And but they felt that void in between that they thought, you know, this is something we really need for our community that we need to have to have this asset. And that's basically the gist of how we were birthed, if you will.
So it started out sort of small in terms of the number of performances, but then it just continue to grow because of the demand?
Well, that's true. And then it also morphed into a fully professional orchestra. So now everyone on the stage is paid a wage. And the expectation is that everyone on stage will have taken a competitive audition in order to gain entry into the orchestra. So we roughly have three or four openings every year because we have musicians coming in and out of the Pittsburgh region. And when we have an opening, we do an all-call. And we have competitive auditions, and people come in. And sometimes we have as many as 16 to 25 candidates for one spot in the Westmoreland Symphony.
Yeah, and the nice thing is that you know, these are people who are very well, you know, extremely talented in what they do. I mean, we're not, you know, we're really getting people the whole way, you know, people who are really, really high tier is what I'm trying to say. You know what I mean? So, we're, you know, it's really, really great.
There are a lot of folks through the years who have spent long periods of time working for and with the orchestra. Crystal Horner, co-founder of the orchestra, led it as, I believe, executive director, one of your predecessors for 25 years.
Yes.
Kypros Marcou served as conductor for 31 years.
That's amazing.
So what is it about this orchestra that people want, once they get there, they want to stay?
Well, from my perspective, the musicians love playing with each other.
Yeah.
They love taking the stage and playing this incredible repertoire because, you know, many of our musicians are freelance musicians in the Pittsburgh region, and they play in the ballet pit, they play for the opera, they play in a lot of different musical ensembles in and around Western Pennsylvania, and some of them even spill over into some of the other groups I work with, like the Erie Philharmonic or the Blue Water Chamber Orchestra in Cleveland, or they might play in the Akron Symphony, the Wheeling Symphony, but often they're playing ballet scores or something like that. So when they get a chance to play Sibelius' Seventh Symphony, they're really excited, and it's a real attraction for some of those musicians to gather to play that specific repertoire.
Yeah, I think it's really a testament to just the camaraderie, you know, I think, and the community spirit that although we, you know, we have moved into a regional orchestra, it's very much, you know, we are here. People come to the orchestra because they know they're going to get quality music, and they know that the musicians are at the highest caliber, but they want to be there just as much as the audience wants to be there, and I think that's what's special.
Yeah, so you talked about the sort of the staying power, the, you know, once you got them, they want to stay. But I understand that you've had some members of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, Pittsburgh Opera, leave their jobs to come to work with WSO. What was it you think that turned them to Greensburg and to your orchestra?
I think it's a special audience. I think we have people that come to the symphony on a regular basis who truly love the orchestra. They identify with the members. Mm-hmm. They love to mm-hmm. interface with them. We have a really strong relationship with the Laurel Ballet, right. which is the resident ballet company in Greensburg. And every year we mount a very popular run of live Nutcracker. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, it's the only Nutcracker in this part of the state that's with a live orchestra now.
Yes, we are the only one in southwestern PA that has a live orchestra. And actually, it's one of those stars alignment moments that it's 50 years for us, but it's 25 years for the Nutcracker partnership. So it's one of those great years.
Yeah, you were talking about the special relationship with the audience, but is it the programming as well, the pieces that you perform that also lures these musicians?
I would say yes, because to some degree we're bringing in some rather famous and mm-hmm. well-known mm-hmm. world artists, some of whom have also crossed the Heinz Hall stage. But we also take the advantage of having this world-class orchestra in our backyard, in that we feature soloists from within the membership of the Pittsburgh Symphony. So Bill Caballero, the principal horn of the orchestra, just soloed with us. Yeah. We've had Gretchen Van Hosen, the principal harp. Yes. We've had George Vosberg, who is principal trumpet. We've had a lot of Noah Bendix Baldwin, Adam Liu, some really fabulous musicians that make up the ranks of the PSO are very happy to come and solo with the Westmoreland Symphony.
Well, that's a great collaboration. But do you ever find yourself sort of competing for guest performers who are coming to southwestern Pennsylvania? Do you compete at all with PSO to get them?
The answer is yes and no. I mean, to the degree that we compete, we just make sure that we program our concerts so that they're not necessarily in conflict with what's happening there. But most orchestras program a good 1.5-2 years in advance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the guest artists that we want, we have to make sure that we get on their book early so that our data is specified and they know exactly that they're coming to be with the Westmoreland Symphony and can arrange their schedule around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, when you see these sort of up and coming artists and you know that, you know, 4 or 5 years they're going to be the it. You know, they're going to be the one that everyone wants to play with or have to their orchestra. And if we can hopefully make that reach out now and bring this world-class talent into what southwestern Pennsylvania, you know, that's very key to how we can be successful.
Dan, I believe you mentioned that when you have an opening, there's stiff competition, lots of applicants for it. So to both of you, what are you looking for when you do bring on a new musician? What is it that you're looking for? What's the it?
Well, the first it is superb technique. Mm-hmm. Someone who plays gorgeously in tune, has a really good sense of internal rhythm, someone who has a good sensibility about how their part fits within the whole.
Yeah.
And that's not easy to communicate in a 5-minute audition or a 10-minute audition. So sometimes we have multiple rounds. We'll hold a first round, and then the second round may be fewer candidates. It may be actually sitting in the orchestra and playing a test week or two to make sure that we're happy with how that relationship's going. And then, of course, in almost every orchestra in the U.S., there's a 10-year review period. So it may be 1 year or 2 years where we assess how that person plays with the other musicians around in the section. Or and if they're a good colleague, do they show up on time? Do they show up well-prepared? All those things that, you know, are kind of part and parcel of being a good colleague.
Yeah, I think, you know, can you handle yourself well on the stage? You know, how well do you interact with the patrons and things? And that's so key, because it's sort of what Dan was saying earlier. Not only are these great musicians, but a lot of them are freelancers and things, are playing a lot of these different organizations. So they have to be great social entrepreneurs, you know, make that rapport and have that technique with the audience.
What does it say for the talent in this region and the desire to have great symphonic music in this region about the success of the two symphony orchestras that are in such close proximity?
I think it speaks to this incredible wealth of talent, and it's not unrelated to the great education that's happening in this region. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's at the university level at CMU or Duquesne or some of the other great institutions around, or it's the very strong instrumental and choral and band instruction that's happening in our region, that all feeds into it. We have a thriving youth symphony as well.
Yes.
That's a big part of what we do. And in fact, we're going to feature them on our opening night concert next weekend by having them play side by side with the professionals of the Westmoreland Symphony on one piece.
Yeah, and sometimes it's really, I mean, the kids just get so excited about playing with it But sometimes it's, you know, they work so diligently, especially for like this piece, that sometimes it's hard to differentiate who's the professional and who's the, you know, who's the amateur high school student, you know, really trying to play to such a great level. And I think the need that I get from the community that people say to me, you know, and I get this question quite often. They say, well, you know, you're so close. Why are you so, you know, what's going on there? And, you know, and I just say the earnest answer that we could say is that people just want it. You know what I mean? Just something, if you ever just go to the store and you think, I really want that box of Rice Krispie Treats. And you just go out, you know, but people just, you know, it's just like that one. There's no second thought about, you know, I could spend my money elsewhere, but I know I'm going to get a quality investment by going to the symphony.
We have just a few minutes left. And you guys intend to really do it up big, celebrate this 50th year. Got a lot planned. To kick off the season, you're bringing in 14-year-old piano virtuoso Maxime Landa. Tell us a little bit about Maxime.
Well, I first saw him at Heinz Hall just last year, and he very famously subbed in for one of Long Long's hands. Yeah. If you remember, Long had an injured hand.
Yeah.
And he hired Maxime and kind of fostered him and coaxed him along. And they actually sat side by side at the piano keyboard and played Rhapsody in Blue in performance with the Pittsburgh Symphony, Long Long with one hand and Maxime with the other. And when I listened to that one hand that Maxime used, I thought, wow, this young man has extraordinary technique, and he has a real musical sensibility. He's able to stay with Long Long, and I thought we need to give him an opportunity to come back and showcase his talents on his own.
Yeah, he is so into what he does, and it's almost one of those moments that after you've listened to something he's done, or just, you know, from talking to him, you kind of look at yourself and go, I think I've really slacked through life, at this young age, and it's just amazing the level.
And now he's joining the WSO to really do it on his own, not just sit in.
Precisely, He will not have Long Long helping him on stage.
Although if we have a guest artist, you know, surprise guest artist, that would...
We wouldn't turn him away.
No, none the least bit.
Okay, just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, also coming up, I believe, is it in February, Chi Yun visiting, violinist.
She's sensational. She has also soloed with many of the top orchestras in the U.S., including the Pittsburgh Symphony. She and I get along really well because we're kind of like mind from an artistic standpoint. She's a fireball. She has this great personality and has this incredibly elegant technique at the violin. And she also has a really interesting story with her instrument, which I think there are a lot of neat stories
to tell. Come on. You can't tease us. Give us a little bit more.
Well, let's just say the instrument she's playing now at one point was buried underground with a previous owner. So it's a little bit of a red violin story to some degree. It's always fun to think about, you know, how these instruments are passed through generations.
Yeah.
But hers spent a little time in the graveyard.
Oh my.
It took a very long winter
hibernation.
It was curing
underneath there. Yeah. Curing in the coffin.
Well, unfortunately, gentlemen, we just have a minute left. What do you hope to see for the orchestra in the future? Is the Palace Theater a good home? What are you hoping for? 1 minute.
I want it to thrive. I want it to continue to make great music. We actually do really love playing in the Palace Theater. It you know, a lot of orchestras play in old movie houses, and some are better than others, but we're lucky because the Palace Theater is actually a very nice acoustic for live orchestral performance. So we're very happy to make that our home.
Yeah, no, it's a you know, Greensburg and the Palace are just such a great place to be, and there's so much going on, and that's, you know, I think our only qualm is, can we get a bigger stage sometimes just to fit more orchestra members and choir members on there.
Okay, just a couple seconds. What else beside those two that we highlighted? Give me one more thing to tease our audience about this 50th season.
Music of John Williams, the great American film composer.
Who doesn't like John Williams?
Going to put together a whole night of his highlights from E.T. and Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark and Harry Potter.
Yeah,
you're going to have a lot of smiles that night.
I think so.
Yes.
All right. Westmoreland Symphony Orchestra Executive Director Endicott Reindl and Artistic Director Daniel Meyer, thanks so much for coming here.
Pleasure, Kevin.
Thank you.
And coming up, the U.S. Senate is set to vote on the next step to confirming Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. The cloture vote is coming up next hour, and we will join NPR's live coverage of the Senate proceedings at 10 o'clock, preempting the first hour of 1A. For today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, how is the city encouraging an exciting, thriving nightlife while still ensuring public safety? A visit with the city's nighttime manager. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.